Welcome to New Books in Sociology. This is your hostess, Annie Sapukaya. Today we are talking to David Chura, author of I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup, published by Beacon Press in 2010. David Chura is a teacher, and for the past 40 years he has worked with at-risk kids, kids that are in the system, foster care, group homes, homeless shelters, drug rehab, and alternative high schools. David is also a writer. In this book, he compiles the stories of some of the teenage inmates he taught during his 10 years working in an adult county prison. Their tales are eye-opening and defying the commonly held notion that there are such things as bad kids. Chura shows, through his writing, the link between poverty and crime, and makes us rethink the increasingly common practice of sentencing minors as adults. David Chura also has a website called Kids in the System, Kids Caught Up, Locked Up in the Social Welfare System. It can be found at kidsinthesystem.wordpress.com. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
We're talking to you about your book, I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup, published by Beacon Press in 2011. So you've been working with kids who are considered high risk for a very long time. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, high risk, kids at risk, high risk children?
Well, when it comes to education, it's usually kids that have difficulty being in a some kind of larger school, sometimes beneath the apparent problem are going to be learning disabilities, but often it's more issues of family problems, abuse, physical and sexual abuse, addiction, either themselves or their parents, and the behavior kind of manifests itself in the classroom. So that those kinds of kids are ones that traditionally are either in the real old days, they just were kicked out totally. But as mm-hmm. we sort of hopefully progress in our thinking, different programs have been set up. So I really, all of my teaching career, I've worked with at-risk adolescents and in alternate, what we call alternative community schools. So these would be kids who would be kicked out of their school and sent to our school, which was a much smaller environment. The rules were pretty, they were enforced, but they were pretty stripped down. So there was not a whole lot of issues of authority, you know, and of power over kids. And it was a much more of a community of learning as opposed to really kind of a big, you know, big structure. So that the risk really was, in some ways, the risk was that things were going to get much worse for them and that this would present bigger problems. And what happened was, for me, I kind of then encountered when I started working in the jail, I encountered mm-hmm. kids who were exactly what everybody had worried about. You know, they sort of had fallen over the edge. I often would say to people, you know, they're not at risk anymore because they're in risk.
They are risk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and they, you know, so that those kinds of kids were the ones that were the most marginalized, you know, barely hanging on to society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how did you end up working in the prison system?
Well, I had been working in a community alternative school for about, I think, 11 years or 13 years. And as the pressures of a lot of the sort of educational standards and the standardized tests and budgets started getting cut, we began to have problems in the school, and the problems came from the fact that our staff was cut down dramatically, but yet we were getting kids who were, you know, pretty disturbed, who had really significant problems, and they weren't getting what they needed, both in terms of counseling support. The class sizes got bigger, but then our teaching staff got smaller, so that the community that we had started really being falling apart, and the trigger for me was that in a school that we had never had any violence whatsoever, there was a very large fight. The whole place just kind of broke out in chaos, and police had to be called. And I just kind of really thought, you know, this is not a place that's going to get any better, given all the budget cuts and the pressure. So I had always known about the program in the jail and heard very good things about what was being done in terms mm-hmm. of creativity with the kids and really making a big difference in kids' lives. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I then worked there for about 11 years.
Wow. Okay. Well, in the title of your book, where it says "Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup," I was wondering, are these jails they're adult jails? They're not places for young people, or are they?
Yes, exactly. That's one of the real issues, and it's one of the things I talk about in the book quite a lot. That these were not what we would call juvenile detention centers, which are really places for young people. Mm-hmm. Who are, it's staffed by people who are trained to deal with kids in trouble. And this was an adult jail. And that has raised in the whole juvenile justice system a real problem for how things are going. And so these are young people that were some as young as 14, 15 years old who were being sentenced to some kind of adult prison time in an adult prison. So mm-hmm. that really became, and that became a real, just about when I started working in the jail, that became really a big issue in the juvenile justice system, that more mm-hmm. and more states were sentencing kids as adults. So they were serving time in adult prisons.
Right. And why do you think that shift began to occur? Like, why are more kids being sentenced to adult prison nowadays?
Well, one of the things was going on is that I think it was sort of the in the middle of a lot of sort of social crises, one of which was the AIDS and HIV crisis. So that mm-hmm. a lot of the kids that I dealt with, their families, they had lost a parent or both parents or family members to AIDS. Mm-hmm. Also, there was people perceive that there was really kind of an influx in crime. And I talk about in the book that there was one particular kind of pivotal moment in a way, and that is was around 1995. There was a social psychologist called John DeLillo who wrote an article for the Philadelphia Examiner. Mm-hmm. And the title was "The Coming of the Super Predators." And he set out the theory that there was this wave of youth crime. And his language was very incendiary and provocative. And I don't think he particularly was trying to do that, but the way he was describing these kids, that he was describing them as being remorseless. They would do anything for, just for the sake of doing it. And mm-hmm. this became a very much of a talked about article in the major newspapers and broadcast. And so this phrase "super predators" really caught on, and mm-hmm. essentially people got very frightened. And when I say people, I mean the sort of general public. And yeah. as a result, there was a lot of pressure on lawmakers to do, quote unquote, do something. So we were sort of in this kind of, the war on crime. It was, we had the war on drugs, and, now we're going to have the war on, war on crime, be tough on crime. So politically, it was a very hot topic in a way. So states just started changing the law where juveniles, where previously they would not be put in adult jails, they would be sent to juvenile detention centers, or they would be put in different kinds of facilities. That they were, that the law, that the age at which they could be held responsible was being lowered in some places very dramatically. Many mm-hmm. states had it at 14, 15, 16 years old. So that was why this tremendous influx of juveniles in adult prisons happened. And we're still in the middle of it. We still have many states still have those kinds of laws. The state that I'm in, Massachusetts, they have 17. New York State, which is where I was teaching, it was 16 years old. And some states in this, like in Florida, it's very young. It's 14 to 15 years old. And so it's taken a lot for states to really begin to examine this. So what you had was a shift from juvenile justice, in which was always had its focus on rehabilitation, to the idea of just kind of punishment and retribution. And it really shook up the juvenile, and has continued to shake up the juvenile justice system and the people who work in it, because it's clearly a very destructive trend. The belief is that they just need to be punished. They can't be rehabilitated or taught any kinds of different behaviors.
Right. Well, it seems like this kind of punitive system, and you argue this a lot in your book, really only focuses on the children as being kind of the product of themselves, kind of like being bad seeds, which a lot of people believe that, you know, some criminals are just like that. They don't look at all the factors around them. So in your experience, what are the factors that lead to this? Because you argue that this is very much not true, that this is completely linked to a whole set of social factors.
Yeah. Actually, it's very well said what you said in terms of that. You know, it's almost as though they were just, this is what their fabric is made out of. And the kids that I taught, invariably, if you looked at their records or their, you know, their, any kind of intervention that's been done, most of them came from families that were very, very fragmented, fragile, single parent, many times raised by a grandparent, an aunt or an uncle. And often that was the result of drug abuse or alcoholism or disease with the parents. Kids were, in many cases, severely abused, both sexually and physically. And I have a story in the book about a young man who, at the age of five, his mother was taken away from him, and she died of an overdose. And he ended up being sort of shuffled from family member to family member, and was very severely abused. And when he came to the jail and I encountered him, he was pretty actively psychotic. And that's a very dramatic case, but there were many, many of these young people who had had those kinds of traumas. Many of them ended up being taken away from families, put in sort of the whole stream of, you know, first put in foster care, and then they acted out in foster care, and then they were put in group homes. And then they kind of, many of them just either ended up in psychiatric hospitals, homeless. It was a real cycle of just going from these different settings. And then until they eventually ended up in jail. And when I met them, many of them had been in jail, had been a part of the juvenile justice system from a very young age. So it was all of these factors, all of this kind of background that just doesn't ever get addressed. You're talking about poverty. You're talking about an education system where, you know, the schools that they went to were overcrowded, and they were, you know, they had no books, and sort of all of the things that would end up shaping a person were manifested in what their behavior was. And often that behavior was one of expressing some kind of sort of frustration and anger and rage, or in some cases just really necessity. You know, the kids that I met who were dealing in drugs, it was a source of income for the families. And we also, I haven't mentioned also that in the jail that I worked in, and I think it's pretty well documented in jails, that, you know, at least probably 90% of the young people, or just the people in jail completely, were people of color. So there was that whole racism issue that, again, was not addressed, and, you know, people continue to address it because it seems to be a very much of a factor in who gets arrested and what kind of jail time that they do.
Right. Yeah, that's a very big problem, isn't it? The role of race in all of this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the statistics are just amazing in terms of if you when broken down state by state about who gets arrested. And for example, the county. Because the jail that I was in was an adult county jail. The county itself was predominantly Caucasian. The minority population was something like 12%. But yet when you went into the jail, which had a couple of thousand people, it was predominantly African American, Latino, with some Caucasians. And it, to me, that was just such a very blatant example of the racism.
Right. And this ties into their economic conditions as well, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of that whole factor, you know, the whole idea of the neighborhoods that they grew up in, you know, mm-hmm. were very poor, drug infested, guns, violence, and many of them were really had the experience of often seeing a friend or a relative killed in the streets, you know, due to either gang activity, crime. So there was this whole atmosphere of trauma for them that just never got and continues not to be addressed.
Right. Something that I kind of wonder is, how did you get them to trust you as their teacher? Because I would imagine that at first they kind of had some resistance to you, or did you not find that to be the case?
Well, you know, whenever I told people that I was teaching in a jail, their immediate assumption was it was a waste of time because these kids, quote unquote, these kids, wouldn't be interested in learning. And actually, it was very much the reverse. And I think there were a couple of factors that were working there, is that the prison environment and the prison culture is just one of real aggression, paranoia, and abuse of, you know, psychological, physical abuse. And so that these young people were living in this environment. So that consequently what happened on the blocks or in their moving around the jail is, you know, one of just always being suspicious, being, you know, kind of arrogant and, you know, kind of projecting this attitude. And school was the one place where they felt safe. It was truly as though they could come there and be, you know, children.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, my teachers and myself included, that I made a point of stressing the fact that as far as I was concerned, they were students. They weren't criminals. I wasn't particularly interested in what they had done. And I gave them that respect. And in turn, and it's very interesting because they were able to really sense that, the idea that they were being respected. And outside the jail, they were not being respected. So that also kind of enabled them to be more trusting. So my experience was really a very positive experience in terms of teaching. These were young people who had dropped out of school, been kicked out of school, and they had never had any success. And again, people's stereotype is that, oh, they're stupid. You know, they're not capable of doing school. They don't want to. And I found that was very often not the case, that they were bright. They had native intelligence. What they lacked was what we teachers talk about as seat time, you know, being in class and doing what they needed to do.
Right.
And so they had no, you know, so jail was, here it was. It was an opportunity. And I would say the majority of my students wanted and tried and did take advantage of that opportunity.
Right. And so did these kids follow a regular school day, or was it just like a small period of time where they could go and have some teaching? Like, did they follow a regular school day?
Yeah. One of the blessings of New York State, which is where I was teaching, which is where the jail was, is that the educational law was that if a young person was of school age, so that would be up to age of 21, they had to be given school with what was expected of them in terms of their high school, say, you know, so that they really got, in our program, we would have, you know, a full morning and we would have a full afternoon. So they would basically go to school from about 8 o'clock until I think it was 11, and then they'd be back around 12 and they would be there until like 2:30. So that they had full classes, and it wasn't, and again, I think it goes back to that, the issue of why did they work, is because the expectations were there. It's like, this was the way the teachers defined it is this is a real school, and we do real school work here. It's not babysitting, it's not entertaining. Right. So it's interesting how they would raise, they would rise to those expectations. So and we had the requirements from the districts that they came that they needed to cover certain topics, and they were held responsible for testing and the standardized tests if they were eligible, if it was time for them to take them. So it was, which kind of made the teaching experience sort of interesting, because it was a very hampering environment. There were many things that worked against us doing our jobs, but we did it, and I think that they sensed that and they appreciated that.
Right. One of the chapters that I found really interesting in your book is when you mentioned the situation with when the chicks were brought in.
Uh-huh, yes.
And how the kids in your class reacted to that. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, what it was is that I was in for a certain period, a couple of years, I was a part of a grant program. And it was still in the jail, in the adult jail. But these students were given very intense sort of training. They had a lot of psychological help. So one of the projects we did as a class is that we had a science project, and we brought in eggs, duck eggs, and they each were assigned to sort of take care of one of these eggs, and we while they were incubating, and then when the chicks were hatched out, they continued to sort of follow that chick. So we talked about the chick dads, that they were sort of taking care of them, and there was this incredible tenderness that just was an amazing thing to see. Kids who had done some pretty terrible things and had pretty disturbing lives, there was just this incredible letdowning of guard, and they were very nurturing and very protective and very proud. And there was one particular young man that I focus on who he himself came from a very, very, very sort of disturbed background. He had been really abandoned by his family, and when he was in middle school, he essentially got kicked out of his house, and he was living on the streets, and had been in very serious trouble, and been at Rikers Island, and he was a thumb sucker. He was, this very kid, six two, big kid, and he sort of would suck his thumb, and anybody make fun of him, he'd sort of lay him out. But he became the real guardian of the whole brood, as it were. And then when his chick came out, it happened to be one that was lame. And he really just adopted that chick and did all kinds of, rehabilitation, as it were. We sort of showed him how to, kind of strengthen the leg and whatever. But it was this... Again, it was this identification, and for many of them, there was this tremendous identification with this tender, vulnerable creature that they were responsible for, and then they ended up wanting to have a race, and so there was this whole issue of we set the chicks up, and they had a race, out of a particular circle, and the young man that I described worked magic, and his chick was the one that won. And so it was this kind of this incredibly moving and touching sort of sense of triumph. One of the things he had said to me was, because there was sort of a festive atmosphere about it, was that he had never been to a party because nobody would invite him to their house because he smelled and he had his clothes were dirty and they were afraid he was going to steal things. And this was like the best party he had ever been to. And it was just, for me, such an eye-opener to how depleted many of these kids' lives were from just the normal things that other kids experience, and just the social things, and then also just the emotional part of it.
Sure. Yeah, it's like they were giving the love that they never had in a way.
Yes.
You also talk about this kid, Jason, who I found very interesting. And you said that he was addicted to the jail system.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find many kids like that? And what exactly does that mean?
Well, actually, I did not find many kids like that, which mm-hmm. is my relief.
Right.
This was a young man who I clearly just never reached him, and I don't know anybody who did. And he had been so accustomed and acculturated to the streets that it was very difficult for him to not be on the streets. And so, in a way, it's kind of I don't know what the term would be, but it was almost like a reverse reaction to what, in some ways, was damaging and hurtful, and many kids wanted to get away from. He had this attraction to it. So he, and again, he was one of those kids where his mother had been addicted. She died. He was taken away. He had himself had a terrible drug addiction problems. And this addiction, it's almost as though the addictive personality just sort of picked up every negative experience and made it something that he craved, so that he would set himself up. He would get into fights with guys that were bigger than he was, older than he was, and a certain bragging about the places he had been in, the fights he had seen, how terrible the jails were. So it was kind of a desperate, and actually now I'm thinking of it, it was a desperate effort to claim some sort of identity for himself. And so instead of trying to do something positive, he kind of just latched onto the negative about, I'm the tough guy. And it was interesting to me that he wasn't somebody who actually garnered much respect from kids or the adults, just thought he was just a stupid kid. Because they were able to see the emptiness of what he was doing. The last I saw him was that he was on his way upstate to do serious, what they would call serious state time, for 5 to 6 years. And he was a young kid. And again, his defense, I think, was that he was looking forward to it. It would be more exciting. There'd be more fights. There'd be more kind of danger. So that addiction kind of really transferred into all the negative in his life. And he would never come to school. He just saw no value in it, which, when I think about it, means he saw just no value to his life at all.
Yeah. Do you think does mental illness play a big role in these kids' lives as well, or do you think it's more a result of their social conditions? Because you did mention one kid who seems to have some kind of problem that he would need to see his own reflection.
Yes,
mentioned some of these kids were psychotic.
Right, yeah. Khalil was a kid who clearly had some real delusional thinking, and his whole obsession was seeing himself. And one of the things that became very apparent to me is the longer that I worked there was that the role that mental illness played. I think one of the statistics I've seen recently was that a quarter of the population of U.S. prisons have mental health issues. And mm-hmm. as you know, we institutionalized mental hospitals and mm-hmm. supposedly broke them up and put people into these community programs. And that effort clearly in certain parts of the population just fell apart, so that you get people in jail who are there because of mental health issues, as opposed to any straight out sort of, their criminal, their quote unquote criminal behavior would be the result of those psychological issues. And one of the things that I found very disturbing when I was working in the prison was the fact that the issues that the kids would come in with, the mental health issues, were not addressed actively. For example, many of them came in, and I had kids who were on medication, who were on medication for depression or bipolar, different, psychotropic drugs, ADD, and supposedly those medications should have been given to them, and they weren't. And one of the things that would happen is that there was often sort of excuse making by the corrections department of paperwork was lost, or they didn't fill out the right form, or it just got neglected. So mm-hmm. the result, as you can imagine, is, you know, a lot of acting out behavior. So it was behavior that was potentially easily curbed and taken care of as if they had gotten the proper medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
Added to that the fact that there was no counseling services. So that being in jail is stressful. Being a kid in jail is even more stressful. So that there was no help for anybody to sort of deal with those things. So the result was that you would have more fights, the tensions would be higher, and it kind of just grew on itself. I had a young man who, it was so graphic to me about what happened to him. He came in, and he was a very good student. He was very quiet, very passive, never really sort of involved with the other guys. And as I was working with him, I could tell that just something was going on. He always sat in the back of the room. His back was to any kind of door. And he would kind of stay after class and he'd talk to me. And he would, I could feel that he was getting, something was going on with him. So I suggested that he talk to we had a really wonderful social worker on our staff, that he talk to our social worker under the guise of saying, well, you know, when you get out, you want to get your GED, so it would be good if you talked with her. And he did. He did that. And so she came to me at the end of the day and she thanked me for sending him. Because his story was that when he was bipolar, that when he came in, he was on medication. He had not gotten the medication for several months, and he could feel himself getting crazy. That's kind of how he put it to her. And he was terrified. He was terrified of what he was going to do. And his mom was an active mom, and she got in touch with corrections, and she was, you know, saying, you've got to give him the medication that controls his behavior, and she was getting nowhere. And luckily, the social worker was kind of like a bulldog, and she just went after all kinds of people to get this kid on his medications. But I was always touched by the idea that he talked about being terrified of what was happening to him and the consequences. I mean, he was a cognizant enough to know, I'm going to just do something crazy and, you know, be thrown in solitary confinement, potentially get beat up, you know, just all kinds of things. So that those mental health issues unaddressed just add this extra layer of essentially abuse within in a pretty abusive system.
Yeah, that's quite unbelievable, all these different diagnoses in one place and without the proper care.
Yes, the issue of somebody being ADD, having attention deficit, you know, I mean, just bouncing off the wall and just giving the medication and it's going to make your life easier, but
it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned solitary confinement. What is solitary confinement exactly? And you do talk a lot about how it affects young people, especially.
Yeah, solitary confinement is essentially, there's two kinds of confinement. One is where it's kind of just what they call sort of a disciplinary confinement. And that would be, say, somebody who got into a fight and they would be put in a cell by themselves and they would be there for 23 hours. They would be in their cell. They would have an hour out. They would have a half hour rec by themselves, and they would take a shower. And that would, you know, that would usually last for a week to a month. Solitary confinement was much more dramatic. It's really complete isolation, and it can vary in different institutions. But the place where I was, they had a very they had a very high tech what they call a special housing unit, and it had, the cells were designed in such a way that you could not, a person an inmate could not see any other inmate in any other of the cells. They couldn't see anybody walking down the hall. The only way they could have any kind of sight line was if somebody stood right in front of their cell. This was a very, very new one. So it was glass, it was cement, it was concrete, and it was metal. And they were locked up in that cell for 24 hours. The reason why they could do that was because next to each individual cell was a unit, another smaller space in which they could do some kind of physical activity. They could do jumping jacks or whatever. So that they never left it. Everything was done in there. Their showering, bathroom, if they needed to make a phone call, because legally, again, they need to have access to legal aid or lawyers. It was all done within that cell, so that they would be isolated for as long as that they were in there. And one of the things that was so striking to me was when I would have young people in there, again, because of the educational law, I needed to have at least some access to them. And I would watch their deterioration. Kids mm-hmm. who had been, you know, pretty alert and took care of their hygiene and respectful, they would just end up, usually the first sign would be that they would start to not shower, and they would sleep all day, and it was very hard to get them to rouse them. The only way I could talk to them was there was a slot in the door, a metal slot where their food tray was put in and taken out. So I would have to get it down and sort of crouch down, and we would talk through this essentially like what's a mail slot, and we would sort of talk that way. And it got to be very hard just to even get them to wake up. And then what had happened is because they had no contact whatsoever, inmates began to realize that they could talk to each other through their rec areas that they had sort of a screening up in the top. So they could yell to each other. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that became so striking was that if they weren't sleeping, they were kind of screaming to each other. And I use the word screaming on purpose because the communication was just, you had to scream so loud that you really couldn't distinguish words or content in any way. But it was the idea that they were in making some sort of communication with another person. So that yeah. it went from like people like sleeping all the time, being really almost, you know, groggy, to this kind of heightened chaos of sound. They just slowly deteriorated. And mm-hmm. after I had left, I think it was a year or so after I had left, the Department of Justice had done an investigation for human rights violations in that particular county jail. And mm-hmm. one of the things that they had discovered was how juveniles between the ages of 16 and 18 were half the population. They were put in there more than the regular population. And the average time, and this still sort of just amazes me, the average time was 365 days. So these kids were in total isolation for that period of time. And one of the results was the fact that these young people suffered incredible mental health deterioration because mm-hmm. they were isolated and they were getting no kinds of support. And that's become a big issue in terms of juvenile justice and across the country, is the use of solitary confinement as a means of discipline. That young people are much more vulnerable because they don't have the resources that, say, an adult would have. They are just very fragile, and clearly it's very formative. And so that there's, you know, a tremendous amount of concern about what that does.
So for a year, they would not have contact with another human being.
Right. Well, the contact they would have would be, say, like if I, you know, a teacher was there, came in, right. You know, I saw them. I would see them like every other day or something like that with a correctional officer.
Right.
So it was extremely limited.
Wow. Yeah. I would imagine that all the screaming and so forth would also be kind of a trying to validate the fact that they were still alive. Because if there's nobody around you ever, you know, at some point you must begin to wonder, am I really here?
Yes,
do I really
exist? Yes. And that was one of the things that was so striking to me, was that even though it was very clear that you know, nobody could really understand what anybody was saying, but it was this issue of somehow they were making contact with another person. And I say in the book, and one of the other things that was very striking to me was the fact that this was something that clearly corrections was unhappy about. I mean, it was pretty deafening, and but there was nothing they could do about that. And it was almost a way for these guys to kind of give it to, shove it to the corrections department. You know, what are they going to do? Go in and, stuff people's mouths kind of thing, So that this whole culture, and one of the things I write about in the book is that there was a culture of solidarity within the solitary confinement unit, in terms of that they had limited sense of who was there. I mean, but it was amazing how they could figure out who was who, just by this sort of screaming sort of thing. But there was this sense, and I write in the point of the story that I was telling is that the young person that I was working with was taking one of the state standardized tests, and somehow they kind of knew that. And the whole place got very quiet, because clearly they realized that this young man was taking a test that was pretty important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it shows this idea of the sense of community that, and kind of the amazing ability of people to form community under the harshest conditions.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. I was reading on your website about how some people criticize you for they accuse you of caring more about the perpetrators of crime than the victims of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminded me of Helen Prejean's story and Dead Man Walking. What do you have to say to these people? How do you react to that kind of criticism?
Well, it's something that I have heard, and as I was writing the book and as the book was being edited and we were talking about publishing it, I kind of knew that there was, clearly I would be the victim of, myself, of, the kind of knee-jerk liberal and, all this kind of stuff. But in thinking about that issue, I mean, about, caring about the victims, because I do spend a lot of time talking about, the perpetrators, as it were, from a very practical point of view, aside from the issue of feeling compassion for the people that have been hurt by crime, it was the issue of, if you just look at it from a pragmatic point of view, that if these young people were not rehabilitated, that the crime was just going to continue. And for crime to continue, there's just going to be more victims. So in many ways, taking care of the youthful offender was taking care of the future offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I kind of came to, because I had been, I think the piece you're referring to is I had been confronted by a guy who really just kind of blasted me at a reading, and it made me pause. I really figured, okay, I got to think about this. And then that whole concept of, crime continues because of the way we deal with crime, and crime has to have a victim, and or often has a victim.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had written another piece on Huffington Post, and somebody confronted me with the idea that, it was a solitary confinement thing, is that, these people who, you don't get put in solitary confinement if, when you, for doing nothing, that, if you kill somebody, rape somebody, shoot them, then you deserve solitary confinement. And I was able to respond to that comment, the fact that most of the young people that I worked with, and the young people that were in the jail, were there for nonviolent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were victimless crimes. And I have to say, I give the guy credit. He backed down. He said, then they shouldn't even be in the adult jail.
Right.
So I think it's kind of this knee-jerk reaction from people of that they've got to be terrible and horrible, or they wouldn't be where they are.
Yeah. I think it's hard to understand. And when you look at the social factors, it's almost worse to think about how the system kind of fails them, and to think about them as victims as well, because that just makes the problem even bigger.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My initial title for the book was called Children of Disappointment, and I have a chapter in the book that sort of talks about the evolution of that. And my realization of exactly what you're saying is that these are young people who, from from a very young age had been really disappointed, let down by just about every adult in their lives, from family, teachers, to social workers, caseworkers, you know, all the people in the child welfare system. And that, you know, they really, that's who they are. They are children of disappointment. And then I kind of made sort of my own bridge to that, and to realize that then the people I was working with, the correctional officers, many of them came from very similar backgrounds. They just had enough of a either a person in their lives or a resource that they were able to kind of not turn the final corner. And
that's interesting.
Yeah. And it, what really struck me was the fact that, you know, then the reality is that every person is a child of disappointment, but that for these young people, they did not have, they had no advantages. The social conditions were such that there was no way that they could rise above it.
Right. So you do believe that something small can make a tremendous difference?
Yes,
in terms
I do. Yeah.
Go for the edge or not.
Yeah. I mean, there was a young person that I worked with. His name is Anthony, and he was a real example of that. His mom had been taken away from his mom because his mom was schizophrenic, and he was put into the child welfare system, and he was raised in a very large child care institution. And he got, you know, he was involved in a life of crime. I mean, he did state time. But in one of his sort of trips back to the county jail, something had happened for him. I think, you know, he had been in contact with school or whatever. And he kind of turned a corner. And this is a young man who put himself, he got his GED in jail. Then he got out, and with the help of the social worker and some support staff, he got himself into a community college. Then he got a scholarship to a four-year school. Then he got himself a scholarship to go to graduate school to become a social worker. And all the while he was doing this, it was that he was working two or three jobs. And he now is a social worker working with at-risk kids. But
so there are success stories.
Yeah, they're absolutely. Yeah. Now, I mean, and the thing is that the resources are not there for every kid to get that, because one of the things that happens pretty traditionally is that there's not, when you're released from jail, you were just released from jail. And in the particular jail that I was in, you would be sort of handed, you know, your clothes in a bag. You'd be given money for the bus, and you were just told not to come back.
Wow.
So that, you know, nothing changed. And they would talk about that. You know, when I would see them, if they came back, I would say, what happened? And they essentially would say, it was the same thing. You know, same neighborhood, the same bunch of people. I couldn't get a job because I had been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, and again, that sort of lack of foresight on society's part of thinking, yeah, it costs money to give these people services. But again, if you want to go back to the victims, if you're going to protect society, you need to make the changes so that these kids who later than become adults don't
Sure.
hurt people.
Right. Yeah. Is there anything that we as individuals can do to help? Because I think most people feel like it's something very far removed from them. You know, I mean, most of us don't have any idea what the system is like, or, you know, we've never been near a jail or never been around these kids.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Is there anything that the, you know, the average person can do?
Well, I think one of the things that is apparent to me is educating yourself about what is. It's amazing to me that the times that when I've given readings or talks, that people really will say, I didn't know. And I think people don't know the abuses that go on, or the way that just the way the system is structured. So I think that paying attention to that is really important, because the laws that changed that allowed us to put kids in prison was a result of public pressure.
Right.
And I think it's the same thing, that if in your state, for example, you know, you get wind of the fact that this is kind of a discussion, that it's important to let your legislator know and to kind of talk about it with family members and friends, It seems kind of like a removed thing, but I think the system, there's actually some motion in the system, some movement in this, and I think in society that there's a certain group of society that begins to realize that just on a practical level, the juvenile justice system isn't working and it's costing money. And so some, like the Supreme Court, for example, has done several cases of really sort of speaking out against, for example, life without parole for, in the beginning it was for young people who had not committed a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And said that that was unconstitutional. Those are kind of like little windows to me that there's some thinking going on. But I think you're right. I think people feel like it's not my kid. It's not anybody that I know. It's not my neighborhood. But it is interesting to me as I've done this, the book and talked about the book, people who would come up to me and say, you know, my neighbor, her son is in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And my dental hygienist, you know, was talking to me about this, you know, and it was very striking to me how it's like a light went off for her of like, yeah, this is not as foreign as it seems.
Right.
And one of the scary things about the system is also with the laws the way they are, when I talk to a young group, I'll talk in college groups and stuff, and I'll say, you know, if you're 17 in the state of Massachusetts, you could be arrested and you could be thrown into an adult jail.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like it doesn't affect me somehow kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's partly just raising that awareness that because these young people don't have anybody voicing these things for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I was felt very impelled to tell the stories of these kids. To put a face on it, to make it more human. That, you know, there are lots of statistics around, but it's kind of like, as you had said, everybody feels like it's, you know, it's too far away. It's got nothing to do with me.
Right.
And I think that there are a lot of factors there, and there are a lot of things that of why people are the way they are, and that if mm-hmm. you don't really understand that it's people we're talking about, then yeah. nothing's going to change.
Right. So if people want more information, they can go to, you have a website, correct?
Yes, I do, yeah. It's www.kidsinthesystem.wordpress.com. Or you could just put in kids in the system,
mm-hmm.
and it comes up. And that's one way, is to kind of keep informed and to know sort of what's going on. I've been sort of buoyed by the fact that I've met law students who are very interested in working in juvenile justice, and mm-hmm. teachers, social workers who are kind of getting very kind of aware and open to this. And it sounds bleak sometimes, but I think there are those kinds of, that kind of movement that can make a difference. And the other reality is that what seems to move us in this country is economics. And it really is becoming pretty financially irresponsible to just keep locking people up. Because, as I said to people, you know, the young people that we just keep locking up, they're good. They're getting older, and so it's going to, you know, the jails are still going to be filled. So, from a purely economic point of view, things need to change.
David, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a really enlightening and terrifying conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
You have been listening to an interview with David Chura, author of I Don't Wish Nobody to Have a Life Like Mine, Tales of Kids in Adult Lockup. Thank you for listening to New Books in Sociology. See you next time.